This week, we're looking at the nation's electrical grid and how we need to change it to be ready for a greener energy future. The old grid was designed to link coal-fired and nuclear power plants to nearby cities and towns, so now there aren't enough transmission lines to connect those cities to the places with the best potential for creating clean energy, places like the sunny Southwest and the windy Great Plains. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren traveled to South Dakota to look at the challenges of getting renewable power onto the grid.
Joel Kyleber drives to the crest of a grassy hill at his cattle farm outside the small town of Winner in central South Dakota. He takes out an anemometer to test how many miles per hour the wind is blowing.
Just as high as 44 and a half. Right now it's bouncing around 30 to 32.
Kyleber doesn't really need to consult a wind meter to know his hills have world-class wind.
There's a lot of wind erosion. There's a lot of building damage. Jim Liggett right down here in the house below us has problems keeping the siding on his house.
This is Class 6, or outstanding wind for a wind farm. But it's bone-chilling for people. Even on a spring day, with the wind chill, it feels like the low teens. So we go inside to warm up.
Okay. The green color on this map.
In Kyleber's large kitchen, he unfolds a map that shows lots of properties around here have been optioned by one wind developer or another. He says one reason ranchers here are so eager is that this place has never been good for farming. He only makes a profit 3 years out of five, and the wind makes this a brutal place for man and beast. In the winter, the wind chill can be 80 below.
Your face will be numb before you get 10 steps out, probably. And if it hits you just right, you won't be able to breathe for a little bit. It'll take your breath away.
He even has to feed his cattle more because of the wind.
That's why you want to see them wind towers, because then you at least see some good out of it.
While we're talking, a wind developer arrives. He takes us outside to show us his plans for Kyleber's property.
That would be a great spot for a series of wind turbines. That's exactly what I think.
Scott Conant is a wind developer for a small Wisconsin company called Prelude Wind Farms. As recently as last fall, he didn't even know that the capital of South Dakota is pronounced Pierre, not Pierre. But after 18 trips, he's learned the contour of the land, the speed and consistency of the wind, and the desire of local residents to host wind farms.
I think that there's no doubt that this can be a 1,000 tower project, and maybe more. The whole package is right here.
Does this area lack anything?
Transmission lines, in a word, or two. And then that's really all it lacks.
That's why Conant and another wind developer are sitting with a couple hundred farmers in Winner Middle School. They came to hear Joe Dudak, a vice president of ITC Holdings Corporation.
Who comes first, the generation or the line? That's been the problem. That's probably plagued the transmission industry for the last 30 years, and that's why no transmission's been built.
For more than a decade, wind developers have been salivating over windy places like this, but wouldn't build wind turbines without transmission lines, and utilities wouldn't string the lines without the wind farms. ITC wants to break that impasse with a $12 billion transmission project.
We think you build it first, and you're there at the same time the wind energy is there.
ITC's project would carry 12,000 megawatts of electricity from the windy northern plains to Chicago and points east. That's enough electricity for about 4.5 million homes. Dudak says the current grid isn't up to the job of bringing green power to millions of homes and businesses. It's a patchwork of transmission lines strung decades ago by utilities, mostly connecting big polluting power plants to local customers.
There is no superhighway system. And there's not enough room right now. The system is terribly constrained right now.
To build its piece of a transmission superhighway, ITC needs lots of money and both federal and state approvals. Dudak's hoping that concerns about climate change and new laws that mandate clean power will translate into a green light.
It's possible we can be breaking ground in 2 years.
But 900 miles away, at a control room for the Midwestern electric grid, talk of a big increase in wind power sends chills down the spine of Rob Benbow. He's a manager at the Midwestern Independent Transmission System Operator in suburban Indianapolis. It's kind of like an air traffic control tower for the electric grid for 13 states. It's before dawn, and a few dozen grid operators are sitting in front of a massive curved screen, 20 feet high and 150 feet long. They're making sure enough power is being generated to match the surge in demand as the Midwest wakes up and turns on coffee makers and hair dryers. They also troubleshoot when power plants unexpectedly turn off. This morning, that warning is someone else's problem. But Bembo worries that when wind power makes up a significant portion of his grid's electricity, managing it will cause him frequent problems.
My biggest fear is if you see 20% wind on your system and then it comes off at a time period where you don't have resources to replace it, that's going to could result in a blackout situation.
Wind power is not predictable. This morning, wind is steadily producing about 3,000 megawatts, about 5% of the total power being used in the region. But that's not always the case. Bembo says he's seen wind power become more variable as more wind farms come online. And grid operators can't order wind plants to produce like they can other plants.
If the wind's not blowing, you just don't have that resource available.
And when the wind is blowing, it can be hard to make wind turbines shut down.
A lot of these plants are not manned. If we need to turn them off, we have to send a person out there to actually do that.
Lots of other things about wind frustrate the Bembos of the world. Wind blows hardest at night when electricity demand is lowest. There currently aren't ways to store it for later use, and you can't count on it on hot summer days when you need it most.
You can put all that wind in, but I still have to have all this other generation that I need to have available, all my coal, nuclear, all the gas for my peak load day.
So when Bembo thinks about lots of new wind turbines and transmission lines to carry their energy towards his control room, he sees more than clean energy. He sees a lot of headaches coming his way. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
All this week, we're reporting on the nation's electricity grid. Tonight on All Things Considered, we'll ask if a smarter grid will necessarily be greener. And on tomorrow's Morning Edition, as a new grid gets planned and built, big power companies are still working to keep America's lights on.
It doesn't have the same kind of sex appeal as new technologies and new sort of golly gee whiz, whether it's a new computer software program or a new computer itself.
You can learn more about the plans for bringing renewable energy to the grid through an interactive map and other resources at npr.org/grid. This week, we're going to take an in-depth look at something we use all day, every day. In fact, it makes just about every part of our modern lives possible. We're talking about the electricity grid. It's outdated and it's ill-prepared for the huge growth that's expected in demand for power. We begin our series with NPR's Jeff Brady.
When it comes to electricity, not much has changed since Thomas Edison fired up the first commercial power grid in New York more than a century back. The fundamentals he pioneered are still at work in a grid that is almost 100% reliable. So for the longest time, just about everything you need to know about electricity could be learned from a cartoon character.
I wash and dry your clothes, play your radios, I can heat your coffee pot.
In the 1950s and 60s, Ready Kilowatt could be found on black and white TVs across the country.
Remember, just plug in. I'm ready.
But then, on August 14th, 2003, a lot of people learned they couldn't take electricity for granted anymore.
A massive power outage has hit cities throughout the eastern United States and parts of Canada.
The blackout extends from New York to Cleveland to Detroit.
More than 50 million people were without electricity for about a day. That actually led to a lot of barbecues and parties. There also were new worries that the nation's electricity grid was becoming old and rusty. Certainly there are places where the grid hasn't kept pace with growth. That's according to Arshad Mansour with the Electric Power Research Institute.
In the Northeast, in the areas of New Jersey, New York, Washington, D.C., on the West Coast, in L.A., San Diego, in that area.
Mansour's group predicts that without big changes, the grid will become increasingly unreliable within just a few years. On top of that, the grid isn't ready for a future that likely includes a lot more wind and solar power. To understand why, we need a little grid education. like in one of those old film strips back in school.
The U.S. consumes 950 gigawatts of electricity at peak usage. The grid consists of almost 5.5 million miles of wires. There are 130 million meters connecting houses and businesses to the grid. This vast network remains stable through a delicate balancing act because electricity can't be stored. The amount generated must always equal the amount used. Otherwise, outages can occur.
Thanks, Mr. Filmstrip announcer.
You're welcome.
Alrighty then. Back to the balance between generation and use. It's fairly easy with coal and gas generators. You just fire one up when you need electricity. But solar and wind are less predictable. With hard-to-predict demand on one side and hard-to-predict production on the other, grid managers face a difficult future. This is where something called the smart grid comes in. All over the country, computer cables are being installed right next to electrical wires so the grid can manage itself. In Boulder, Colorado, XL Energy is creating the first smart grid city. Chris Ferrugia is a field supervisor for the utility, and he's pointing up at a power pole.
What you're looking at is an aluminum box that's about 12 inches by 15 inches. So
many of the power poles in this neighborhood have similar boxes. Each represents a place where data about the electrical grid can be collected. That information gets sent to computers that can make quick decisions to efficiently manage the grid. This $100 million project in Boulder includes changes inside customers' homes, too.
So this is the GridPoint appliance.
We're in Ray Toomey's laundry room, and he's pointing to something that looks like a small refrigerator, but actually it's a battery unit. XL Energy can store electricity here, and down the road, say when everyone is using their air conditioners one hot afternoon, the utility can pull power out to meet peak demand without firing up an expensive generator. The utility also installed sensors in Toomey's home so he can monitor his electricity use on a laptop.
I love geeking out to this kind of stuff. It's great, and I'm learning a lot.
Already, Toomey found out his air conditioner was pulling a little bit of power, even though it was turned off. He stopped that by cutting the breaker. Eventually, every home may have technology like this. Imagine being able to turn your heat up or down from your computer at work. But it's a long haul from where the country's grid is right now. Consider every power pole and house in the United States, and you start to get a sense of the huge project that's about to be undertaken. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
All this week on this program and on All Things Considered, we'll hear more about remaking the country's power system. And you can see an interactive map of the electricity grid at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. And now it's time for All Tech Considered. Hard times are leading many of us to pay greater attention to our personal finances. We're thinking more carefully about what we spend and where we spend it. And this week, we're focusing on a new generation of websites that are trying to make it easier to work out precisely where the dollars and the cents are going. NPR's Katia Dunn set out to try one of the most popular. It's called Mint.com.
In my household, there are so many things we like doing better than managing our finances, like video golf, which was what my fiancé, Joel, was doing when I tried to enlist his help in signing us up for an online financial management program.
So do you want to stop playing video games and...
Can I just finish this round?
But our finances.
I know, but I'm playing better than I've ever played.
Okay.
Mint.com is designed in part to help financial slackers like us.
So it just basically puts your finances on autopilot.
Aaron Patzer is the founder of Mint.com, a free financial planning site. He started his company 2 years ago.
I sat alone in a room for 7 months, worked 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, and came up with the core algorithms behind Mint.
Once you've created an account, Mint sorts out your finances. It draws simple charts that show you where your money is going. It prompts you to pay your bills on time. It suggests ways to make the most of credit card incentive programs. Some professional financial planners say programs like this can be a useful tool, but they still don't do the really hard work, like rounding up your financial documents and putting them into Mint's database. That's time-consuming. Also, there's the psychological side of finances.
It's just data. You have to have someone on the other side asking the right questions about what's your goal here.
Monique Tilford is with a nonprofit money management program called Your Money or Your Life. She says some people are reluctant to take an honest look at their finances.
If you put in, let's say, how much money you're spending on alcohol, if that's under groceries, you're not going to see it.
After I persuaded Joel to put our financial data into Mint, we took a close look at our spending over 6 months. We examined how much we spent eating out compared with groceries. Actually, it was pretty reasonable.
Were you nervous to see this number because you didn't want to know what it was?
Yes. I was avoiding trying to figure out exactly how much we spend on going out and drinking. And it turns out, had I done that earlier, I would have not felt bad at all.
Mint.com's Patzer says he believes using online tools can give people more of a sense of control over their money. Soon, Mint will be introducing an incentive program. First, it has you round up data, then it charts it. And finally, the program moves you slowly towards setting goals. You win points when you succeed. But he says the incentive program will be optional. He doesn't want to lose customers who can't bring themselves to come clean about where their money is going.
That's NPR's Katie Adun, and we're joined now by Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman, and he's a regular part of our Monday Tech Conversations. Hello, Omar.
Hi, good to be here.
Now, I'm curious, are you one of these hip, web-savvy users with financial management skills that are now turning to Mint.com to figure out where your money goes?
No, I'm really not, and I'm generally not hip in the first place. But no, I've actually been watching a lot of my friends and coworkers migrate to sites like Mint, and use the iPhone app and things like that. And I'm still rocking Microsoft Money 2002, like I'm in the Stone Age. And my wife is still using a paper ledger. So no, we're not quite there yet. Actually, this is one of the cases where I definitely wasn't up to speed on the latest when we started working on this piece. But just from playing with a lot of these sites over the weekend, I think I've kind of seen the light and I'm ready to take my finances to the next level, the 2.0 level.
You know, you noted that some people are actually doing this on their iPhones or using applications for their personal data devices. It seems when I look at a lot of these sites that they're designed for a younger, hipper generation. Maybe we're not a part of it, but it seems like that's exactly who they're designing for.
Yeah, they definitely look like more fun to use. They look more like social networking sites. They definitely are targeting kind of a different audience than the people you would traditionally think, we're using Quicken or Microsoft Money. But even those sites, even, like Quicken Online, is kind of going after that audience as well.
I like the names also, SmartyPig.com.
Smarty Pig, Wasabi, Thrive, which the other website is just thrive.com. And a lot of them have that sort of internet startup feel to them. I was looking at some of the About Us pages for some of these sites, and they all look like young, hip employees at any .com startup. You're kind of trusting them with your finances.
Well, speaking of trust, my, immediate question would have to do with trust and security. What do sites like this do to ensure the safety of the users? I mean, you're handing over credit card information, loan information, all kinds of personal information.
Well, they're doing a lot of things that the online banking sites do, secure web servers, encryption, virus and spyware protection. Mint especially, they claim, we're doing the same kind of security that you would find on these financial institution websites. One site that I talked to, SmartyPig, they're FDIC insured through a community bank in Iowa. So, and another way that they're protecting your data is by decentralizing it. They might never ask you for your social security number or even your first and last name, and the passwords and logins you enter would be stored in a different place as the actual data. So even if someone hacked into your account, they might get some of that information, but they wouldn't know who you are or any of your bank account information. They wouldn't be able to do anything with it.
Omar, one of the things that I thought was interesting about the sites when I just sort of cruised through some of them is the way that people are so open in the internal blogs on some of the sites. You have people talking about how much they spend on moisturizer or how much, one person was worrying about whether or not they should get a pet, and they actually were trying to figure out how much money that would cost. And there was a lot of information that they were sort of putting out there in the open on a subject that people are normally very private about.
I think so, because I think right now on sites like Facebook, you have this culture of sort of helping each other, of presenting a problem and having the community help you solve it. I guess like a sort of personal crowdsourcing where you kind of have all of your friends and maybe even people who have some financial expertise giving you help and advice. And a lot of these sites are employing some element of financial experts, people you can either connect with personally or, you can send an email and get an answer back or kind of a forum structure. So really that's what the sites are aiming for, not just to inform you better about your habits, but also giving you a structure to change your habits or move in the right direction.
The way you spend your money in some ways says something about
who you are and how you live your life. Is there anything surprising that you found out about yourself?
Well, just based on 1 month of bank statements, apparently my biggest expense is transportation, so it tells me I'm commuting a little bit too much, probably.
Buy a bike.
Simplify.
Well, Omar, this all sounds interesting. I assume that you will be posting links on our website.
Yes, I'm going to be posting links to all of these financial sites as well as a lot of news stories that we found related to them on the NPR blog at npr.org/alltech.
Thank you, Omar.
Thanks. Have a good week.
That's Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman, and he talks to us most Mondays.
Welcome back to All Things Considered. I'm Jackie Lardon.
Good morning.
Hi. How are you?
We're in the rolling hills of Central Virginia at the home of author Mark Halperin. He wrote the novels A Soldier of the Great War and Winter's Tale, among many others. 2 years ago, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that inspired a huge internet backlash. He's written a book about that called Digital Barbarism, A Writer's Manifesto. But before we talk about that, Halperin shows me his home library.
It's 16 feet high by 50 feet long. And there are approximately, in this one wall, there's about 8,000 books.
I take a closer look.
I am climbing the two-story ladder up to the crow's nest. And I'm looking as we go. Here's A Soldier of the Great War. And now I'm up to Freddy and Federica. This is the
Italian
edition. National
touch the ceiling.
Bestseller.
Okay, now look down, Jackie.
I don't want to look down.
Halperin treasures physical books, but worries that their days may be numbered. About 30 years ago, he had a conversation with his father. The older man remembered the first movie he saw as a kid.
It was the first time that he had ever seen motion that was not in real life. In other words, a depiction which was moving, a moving picture. He said, and then they put this on celluloid, and then they made it into talkies, and then it became color, and then it became television, et cetera, et cetera. And this was 1975. He didn't know about Moore's Law. But what he said was that he had observed that over time, it was possible to compress more and more information into a smaller and smaller space. And he said, so what I have figured is that if you're going to do this, because I just sold my first book, you've got about 25 or 30 years, he said, after which it's going to change radically. And he was right on. I mean, he knew exactly what he was talking about.
Well, let me talk about this little essay that you wrote a couple of years ago for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Your argument was that authors should hold on to their copyright works much, much longer. I don't know that we necessarily mean forever, but longer than 70 years, yeah, which is the current limit, mm-hmm, after the author's death. And on the surface, it seemed like an interesting thesis and something that might make waves in literary circles, but not outside that, really. How many comments did you get on that piece, Mark?
I got 750,000 nasty comments.
Did you feel like a monk who had wandered into Shea Stadium or Times Square?
Well, I felt like someone selling rosaries in Mecca. You know? But I have to add that although the Times, according to the editor's sacred prerogative, said a great idea lives forever, why shouldn't its copyright? First of all, you can't copyright an idea. It's not in the purview of copyright.
So it was an imprecise title that you didn't choose.
Well, I'll say. And secondly, I did not endorse, nor would I ever endorse, a perpetual copyright, because in the Constitution it says for limited times. And as an originalist, I don't screw around with the Constitution. My idea was to extend it another 10 or 20 years so that it would benefit grandchildren as well as children.
Let me ask you about your book, because then you have just written this new book called Digital Barbarism, and you argue that the first target of what you call the barbarians is copyright and the individual voice. And I would like to ask you a little bit, who are you identifying, or what are you identifying as barbarism, and who are the barbarians? Are you being funny?
Oh, no. I'm absolutely serious. I think it's a new type of barbarism in which the possession of power is the determinant of action. The fact is that the digitalization makes it very easy to copy things, as music piracy and video piracy, and then eventually now book piracy too, illustrates. And it's barbaric in that people say, we have the power to do this now, therefore we will. There is no restraint to this power. That's barbarous.
So you were talking about your dad's perspicacity, and mm-hmm. he had an idea about where you would be 30 years hence. What do you think the role of the author will be 30 years from now?
I dread it, because I think that the what I call the individual voice may be subsumed in a kind of collective coordination in which there isn't much of an individual voice left. And it's the ability of someone to go in and change. And this is part of, by the way, what for many in this movement is a great attraction, which they call remix. That to me is a nightmare.
Or mashups, literary mashups.
Yeah, exactly. And let
we
me
just
tell
did one, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Yeah. Once it's out of copyright, one can do that. Presumably it's had enough time to set in the public mind. But if there were no copyright, or if copyright were truncated, no, that would be a real nightmare. But let me tell you a story about that, if I may. Mm-hmm. In my younger days, I wrote a lot of speeches. There was one instance where I wrote a speech, and the White House got back to me and said, oh, well, we really like this, and we're going to use parts of it. And I said, no, you're not. And they said, well, what do you mean? Are we going to use so-and-so and so-and-so? I said, no, you're not going to use it. You're not going to change a word unless I agree, and you will not chop it up, and you will not take from it. And they said, well, who are you to dictate to us? I said, essentially, I didn't use this language, but I said essentially like, hey, baby, this is copyrighted. It was like holding up a cross in front of a vampire. Even the president of the United States could not force a change in what I had written because it was copyrighted. And I think that is really, really important, because who the hell am I? You know, I have no power, but this gives power to me as an individual, and therefore, by extension, to every single individual person in the country.
Mark Halperin. His new book, Digital Barbarism, A Writer's Manifesto, hits the stores this week. One of the most prominent opponents to Halperin's idea to extend copyright has been Lawrence Lessig. He's a professor of law at Stanford and the founder of Creative Commons, a system that allows creators to opt out of certain copyright protections. Unlike Halperin, he believes in the power of group collaboration to build ideas, so instead of writing a response himself, he crafted a wiki and asked his followers to work together to write a response. He says that he understands Halperin's concerns about intellectual work being altered, but Lessig says when you're a published author, it comes with the territory.
What comes with that is a recognition that my ideas and my writing at some point will be free for others to build on and change and criticize or ridicule, however the public chooses to do it. If I don't want my work used in that way, I'm perfectly free to write a diary that I keep in my desk that nobody gets access to.
You can hear my interview with Lawrence Lessig and read an excerpt from Mark Halperin's new book, Digital Barbarism, at our website, npr.org.
Now to an online game that's a big hit among college students wanting to harness political power. Go Cross Campus has rules similar to Risk, that board game of world domination. In this contest, students forego the little plastic soldiers and do battle on virtual territory. From member station WNPR in Connecticut, Diane Orson reports.
Thousands of armed Yale students vanquish Brown's pitiful forces. The commander orders troops to gather quickly on the Massachusetts border. Now Yale's militia invades Cambridge, humiliating Harvard in a bloody slaughter.
It's mad. It's pure madness. I'm hoping he attacks. Ooh, you see?
19-year-old Yale freshman Emmanuel Corti studies the computer screen, feverishly attacking and seizing virtual school campuses. Students plot out strategy during internet chats, but Corti says they're so serious about it that they also meet in real life. The web just isn't safe.
Because of spies, you have people who say they support Team Yale but have, for whatever reason, an affection for Harvard, for example. And so when plans are discussed in the secret Yale team chat, they copy and paste this in an email and send it to Harvard commanders.
More than 70,000 students have played the game. 5,000 participated in the last Ivy League tournament, billed as the largest competitive event in the history of the Ivy League. Prepare for awesomeness. GoCrust Campus is the brainchild of one Columbia student and a handful of Yalees, including Brad Hargraves.
Online gaming has gotten a really bad rap. People conjure up images of the guy sitting in his mother's basement eating a bag of Cheetos playing World of Warcraft.
Most video games are pretty solitary. GoCrust Campus is played on teams, so it's a collaborative social experience, says co-founder Matt Breimer.
We like to think we're pioneering this kind of team-based social gaming space, bringing spirit, I would say, of team sports to the online world of gaming.
Inc. magazine has named GoCrust Campus one of America's top 10 coolest college startups. Back at his laptop in New Haven, Emmanuel Cortes moved from mere campus battles to conquering the world.
I have very little opposition currently, so I'm just going to sweep as many territories as I can.
And after a quick jolt of global domination, it's back to the books. For NPR News, I'm Diane Orson in New Haven.
Now to another front in the fight to protect intellectual property, the battle against cyber squatting. That's the practice where someone impersonates an individual or a company online. The idea is to sell that website or profile to the real deal at a later date. You're probably aware that that's been going on the web for years now. Maybe someone even got your name before you did. Now, social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter are plagued by the problem.
There's somebody Twittering right now saying they're Susan Boyle. It's clearly not Susan Boyle. You know, there's James Murdoch on there. It's not James Murdoch.
But that is Julia Angwin. She's a technology editor at the Wall Street Journal and author of the book Stealing MySpace.
All these sites that claim to authenticate identity are really using sort of halfway measures, and none of them are foolproof.
Here's a case in point, Twitter. The service bans the sale of its accounts, but recently, Angwin says CNN got around those rules with one cyber squatter. He'd been tweeting under the name CNNBRK, like breaking news, I guess. The cable network ended up taking over the account and signing him to a consulting deal.